Chapter 12. Trump loses his way and then his nerve. Whenever U.S. attention to Iran faded, especially for Trump, I knew Tehran would help us return it to the top of his agenda. So it was no small matter when the Ayatollah Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, offered a helpful explanation of what Iran's well-organized protesters intended when they shouted, "Death to America," along with "Death to Israel," their favorites. "Death to America," said Khamenei, meant death to Trump and John Bolton and Pompeo. These outbursts of inadvertent truth, like who Iran's leaders were targeting for death, reminded us of the continuing need to exert maximum pressure on Tehran. It was due to not just Iran's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs, but its continuing role as the world's central banker for terrorism and its aggressive conventional military presence across the Middle East. One very contentious issue was whether to designate the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization, a statutory term carrying specified consequences for the organization so named. Trump wanted this designation, as did Pompeo and I, because dealing with a group so listed and its agents risked felony charges. Mnuchin worried that this designation for the elite wing of the Iranian military, or even for the Quds Force, its expeditionary arm deployed abroad, currently in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen, would have widespread consequences, a concern I didn't understand. I thought the whole point was to inflict as much pain as possible on these terrorists. Other agencies had varying positions, the general thrust of which was, couldn't we just leave well enough alone without making more work for us? The real opposition came from the government's permanent bureaucracy. Attorneys in the State Department's legal advisor's office simply held the issue for months, not informing the legal advisor herself. Attorneys at Homeland Security did essentially the same thing, hoping the issue would just go away. And during our efforts in March 2019 to move the process along, lawyer time in many key agencies was consumed by disputes over how to fund Trump's Mexico border wall, which had long been the administration's very own La Brea tar pit. There were legal issues, such as whether the applicable statute permitted designating all or part of a government as a foreign terrorist organization, or whether the statute only applied to non-state actors like Al-Qaeda. The Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel split that baby in March 2019, concluding that a government entity, such as the Revolutionary Guard, could receive the designation, but not an entire government. This Solomonic conclusion limited the potential impact of the decision, which I didn't see as a plus, but we were only after the Guard to begin with. Further conceptual debate seemed unproductive. There was a legitimate concern that action against Iran could increase the risk to U.S. forces in Iraq and across the region. But this argument proved too much. As was too often the case, the Defense Department indiscriminately deployed this objection against numerous ideas to increase pressure on Iran. The answer to the Pentagon's worries about pressuring Iran was to increase our force protection capabilities in Iraq, assuming you believed U.S. forces should stay there. It was not to ignore the larger strategic threat of Iran, the aspiring nuclear power, by inverting U.S. policy priorities, elevating Iran's threat inside Iraq above Iran's worldwide nuclear and terrorist threats. This inversion increased daily as Iran gained greater influence in both the Baghdad government and through its organization of Iraqi Shia militia groups into surrogate arms of the Quds Force. I worried, as the old admonition said, that the generals were still fighting the last war rather than the current threat. Supporting a government in Baghdad, as we did after the Second Gulf War, hoping it would become representative and functional throughout Iraq, was one thing. Propping up a regime that did not control Iraq's Kurdish territories, had minimal support among Sunni Arabs, and took its orders on truly critical issues from Tehran, was something else entirely. Day after day of bureaucratic guerrilla warfare ensued during the second half of March, but by this time, I was confident the outcome was not in doubt, despite destructive leaks by opponents predicting the direst of consequences from the terrorist designation. Finally, on April 8th, Trump made the announcement, adding a powerful new tool to our maximum pressure effort. This pressure would have been more maximum if it had been applied 6 months or more earlier, but it demonstrated a seriousness of intention now added to the massive economic effects of the sanctions themselves on Iran. The squeeze was growing. Commentators remarked periodically how often the administration resorted to sanctions and tariffs as instruments of national power. This may be true compared to earlier presidents, but there is no evidence these measures were truly effective, systematic, or well executed. The real story was much more complex, primarily because neither Trump nor Treasury Secretary Mnuchin was interested in or willing to pursue a sanctions policy with resolve and consistency. To the contrary, Mnuchin argued that the constant use of sanctions and the pressure we put on the international financial system would result over time in the tools being weakened, as states impacted by the sanctions sought to evade them. He argued further that using access to the U.S. financial system as one of our main tools would undermine the status of the dollar as the world's reserve currency and encourage others, like Russia and China, to conduct transactions in euros or through counter-trade and other techniques. It was a given that countries would try to evade sanctions. The real reason sanctions were not as successful as they could have been was not that they were used too frequently, but that they were used ineffectively in both the Trump and Obama administrations. And while concern for losing the dollar as the reserve currency was legitimate abstractly, there was no real alternative in sight for miscreant nations until far into the future. Moreover, both Mnuchin's arguments amounted to saying that the threat of sanctions was more effective than the application of sanctions, which was manifestly incorrect. The right way to impose sanctions is to do so swiftly and unexpectedly. Make them broad and comprehensive, not piecemeal, and enforce them rigorously, using military assets to interdict illicit commerce if necessary. This was the formula the Bush 41 administration used immediately after Saddam Hussein's August 1990 invasion of Kuwait with devastating effect. But even there, it was not sufficient. Although badly weakened, Iraq still smuggled out enough oil to survive, thus ultimately necessitating military force to oust it from Kuwait. But for a roadmap on imposing sanctions swiftly and comprehensively, UN Security Council Resolutions 661, enumerating the sanctions on Iraq, and 665, authorizing the use of military force to carry them out, remain key documents. Instead, especially under Obama, sanctions began to be applied as if they were individual judicial decisions against specific entities and individuals. This approach did exist under certain sanctions authorities in U.S. law, intended for more limited purposes than dealing with massive threats like Iraq in 1990-91, but it was a mistake to expand the practice. Instead, legislation should have been amended where necessary to allow for sweeping sanctions without quasi-prosecutorial investigations and quasi-judicial determinations at the Treasury Department. Trump and Mnuchin did not reverse these Obama-era policies. Ironically, they were expanded and institutionalized. The sanctions decision-making process came to resemble the Jarndyce v. Jarndyce litigation in Charles Dickens' Bleak House. Moreover, Mnuchin himself was so averse to negative press coverage that he approached every potentially controversial sanctions decision nervously. In the administration's early days, Mnuchin relished the publicity he received when imposing new sanctions. But when things got stickier and more complex, he became more and more jumpy. Returning to government after a dozen years, I was surprised to see how large a policy role the Treasury Department now played in sanctions decisions. Rather than being simply an operational enforcement mechanism, Treasury now aspired to do foreign policy, which was, to my mind, inappropriate. It also raised the issue of whether, as with other Treasury law enforcement functions earlier moved to Homeland Security, the sanctions enforcement process should go somewhere else, justice, commerce, or even defense. The risk of undermining the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency was theoretically important, but that risk existed independent of the effects of U.S. sanctions. Other currencies already had major roles in international financial matters, and the advent of the euro created an even more significant competitor. On the other hand, some countries pegged their currencies to the dollar, and economists spoke of national economies being dollarized, sometimes by official decision and sometimes just through real-world practice. Trends were hardly all in one direction. In fact, the threat to the dollar's status turned into simply one more Mnuchin argument when he was anxious about imposing sanctions and risking media criticism. As Wilbur Ross said in the context of Venezuela, Mnuchin often seemed more protective of U.S. firms that were sleeping with the enemy than of accomplishing the mission we were trying to achieve. It is rare indeed in the hard, chaotic world of international affairs when the threat of action is actually more powerful than the action itself. If America's economic swords had been sharper during the Trump administration, we would have accomplished much more. One issue that should have been among the easiest to resolve, but which was actually one of the most exhausting, was how tightly to squeeze Iran's oil industry. The common response to any proposal to tighten oil sanctions against Iran, or Venezuela for that matter, was invariably that global oil prices would spike dramatically. Most of this noise came from Mnuchin and Treasury, an unexpected source of expertise on global oil markets. National Economic Council Chairman Larry Kudlow, Energy Department Secretary Rick Perry, and Council of Economic Advisers Chairman Kevin Hassett repeatedly argued that global supply and capacity levels would mitigate the price effects of tighter sanctions. Hassett stressed the interesting statistic that increases in domestic U.S. oil production since Trump's election dwarfed the decreases in Iran's sales implied by eliminating waivers on purchasing Iranian oil granted to some countries, mistakenly, in my view, when sanctions took effect in November 2018. Moreover, he pointed out, given America's enhanced role as an oil producer, rising oil prices actually boosted U.S. GDP, even if higher consumer prices had corresponding negative effects. Overall for us, it was basically a wash economically. But Mnuchin's arguments carried weight because Trump invariably believed our allies were not doing enough. This was certainly true on Iran. France, Germany, and the UK spent their time trying to save the Iran nuclear deal rather than pressuring the Ayatollahs. Neither they nor Americans who supported Obama's deal ever believed unilateral U.S. sanctions could devastate Iran's economy, although that was exactly their effect. They opposed proving the point more graphically by making the sanctions ever stricter. Accordingly, success in tightening sanctions was mixed. Had we hardliners persuaded Trump to bear down on Mnuchin, we would have seen even more dramatic economic decline in Iran, but that was not to be. Trump could initiate policies, but his lack of consistency, steadfastness, and resolve invariably undercut them. So it was on Iran's sanctions. One important loophole for Iran was the oil waivers granted to 8 countries: Taiwan, China, India, Japan, South Korea, Italy, Greece, and Turkey, when renewed sanctions took effect in November 2018, 6 months after U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear deal noted earlier. Taiwan, Greece, and Italy quickly halted purchases of Iranian oil, so not renewing their waivers was a given. States' bureaucrats found endless reasons to extend the other waivers as clientitis took hold. "But India is so important," or "Japan is so important," said officials, arguing the interests of their countries rather than the U.S. interests at stake. One of the worst cases involved India, which, like the others, was buying Iranian oil at prices well below the global market because Iran was so desperate to make sales. India complained it would be disadvantaged not only because of having to find new suppliers, but also because the new sources would insist on prevailing market prices. India's making this argument was understandable, but it was incomprehensible that U.S. bureaucrats echoed it sympathetically. Pompeo was wobbly, caught between conflicting pressures. He also doubted the Arab oil-producing states would really fulfill their promises to boost production to make up for the loss of Iranian oil under the waivers. And, of course, global oil prices would spike. Trump, while oscillating on any given day on any given issue, had been vibrating increasingly on the end the waivers side of the scale. He said expressly in the Oval on March 25th, "I'm ready to cut them off." And on April 12th, he said, "Increase the sanctions. Max them out. Do it right away, including on the oil." And on April 18th, said, "Go to zero." In a phone call with Pompeo, Trump had not been sympathetic to India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, saying, "He'll be okay." I recall a similar conversation reflecting Trump's indifference to notifying allies about waiver decisions. Considering one foreign leader's trip to Washington, which also raised the ending of a waiver, Trump had a ready suggestion. "Do it before he gets here, and then I'll say I didn't know anything about it. And do it early in the week. I don't want to be anywhere near it." On April 22nd, after 6 months of endless, needless, time-consuming opposition by many within the administration, but with widespread Republican congressional support for so doing, the White House announced the end of the waivers. Many in the media who had listened to the bureaucracy's leaks to the contrary were surprised. U.S. military and civilian personnel in the region were rightly on alert for an appropriate period, and we made it clear we would hold Iran responsible for any retaliation. This was an important step forward, although the waivers should never have been granted to begin with. The original sanctions were announced in May 2018, taking effect 6 months later. That was more than enough time for all concerned to make alternative arrangements. The real conclusion was that sanctions for any new transactions should have taken immediate effect upon the Iran nuclear deal's termination. It may have been appropriate to grandfather existing transactions that had been innocently entered into, but 6 months to wind these deals down was far too generous. 90 days was plenty. Giving Iran a full 6 months before either existing or potential transactions were brought under the axe was a gift from Allah Tehran didn't deserve. The next administration should fix Mnuchin's approach immediately so everyone will be on notice that sanctions are an economic weapon we will use effectively, not something we feel guilty about deploying. Another set of waivers causing endless controversy was the nuclear waivers, allowing for Western assistance or cooperation with elements of Iran's purported civil nuclear program. Dating back to the reinitiation of sanctions in November 2018, the State Department, over NSC objections, originally issued 7 such waivers. Not all the waivers were equally serious in promoting Iran's nuclear work, but the political symbolism was bad. As the May 2019 sunset of the waivers approached, we sought internal administration agreement to end at least some and reduce the waiver period to 90 days for others. Our efforts were not as productive as I had hoped, largely because the State Department waged trench warfare to save as many waivers as it could. Nonetheless, in early May, we terminated 2 waivers, bringing us down to 5, and all those remaining were limited in both duration and scope. Before I left, the epicenter of resistance to killing the waivers had shifted to Mnuchin and Treasury. They argued that lifting the waivers would hurt significant Chinese and Russian interests, so we should therefore extend them. Mnuchin, Pompeo, and I argued this out in front of Trump in the Oval on July 25th, and Mnuchin's concerns for China and Russia prevailed over my effort to increase pressure on Iran. Pompeo was largely silent. Trump often complained that people all over the world wanted to talk to him, but somehow they never got through. So, not surprisingly, he eventually began musing about opening discussions with Iran. That country's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, gave a series of interviews in New York saying Trump wanted to talk, but that Bibi Netanyahu, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and I were trying instead to overthrow the Ayatollah's regime. If only. Beyond that, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani wanted to talk. Putin wanted to talk. Everyone wanted to talk to Trump, but someone was cutting him out. Of course, neither Putin nor Rouhani had made any effort to contact us, and to the extent Zarif and others spoke to the media, they were playing to Trump's vanities. The latest variation on this theme, perfected by Kim Jong-un, was to criticize Trump's aides, presumably to convince Trump only he could make a difference. Iran, Cuba, and North Korea all tried it again in late April, and there was every reason to believe the tactic would spread. Such an approach was quite astute, because that's exactly what Trump thought. What he couldn't accept was that these adversaries wanted to talk to him to get a better deal than by negotiating with his troublesome advisors. I figured I'd tell Trump that the day I walked out the door, which was getting closer. In his April White House meeting with Abe, Trump said neither Pompeo nor I had much of a relationship with Iran, and he had no relationship at all with Iran, but Abe did. This is what Trump thought international geopolitics was all about. Maybe that's how it is in the New York real estate business. In retrospect, these remarks were the first indication Trump had a job in mind for Abe, one that could lead to no good end. This discussion did not go far before Trump, still in the stratosphere over the morning's excellent economic news, veered off to sideswiping Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell as that idiot at the Fed for pursuing higher interest rates. On April 30th, however, in a phone call with Francis Macron, Trump raised the idea again, encouraging Macron, who lived for the Iran nuclear deal, to seize this apparent opening in the U.S. position. Trump, almost alone among world leaders, never saw these bids for conversations as weakening our overall position, although others, friend and foe alike, saw them exactly that way. Trump couldn't stop himself. I'm a talker. I like to talk. Grand strategy in the Trump administration. Simultaneously, Iran was gearing up a major campaign against U.S. interests in the Middle East. Iran armed Yemen's Houthi rebels and Iraqi Shia militia groups with more sophisticated missile and drone weaponry. The Quds Force, effectively the creator of Lebanon's Hezbollah, was a critical prop for Assad's regime in Syria, and both Beirut and Damascus benefited from increased military capabilities supplied by Tehran, at least when Israel wasn't destroying Iranian shipments with repeated airstrikes in Syria and later Iraq. Iran also expanded assistance to the Taliban, proving yet again it was an equal opportunity state sponsor of terrorism, Sunni or Shia, as long as it served Iran's national interest. As a defensive response, the Pentagon increased U.S. military assets in the region, including expediting the deployment of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln and its strike force. We issued an explanatory public statement on May 5th, which went out over my name. This caused tremors in the press, wondering why it hadn't come from the Pentagon. The answer? Dunford called to say, "Hey, Ambassador, I need some help here," trying to get the statement through the White House bureaucracy, which increasingly felt as cumbersome as the rest of the government. Dunford said to me a few days later, "We have a saying, in war, sometimes simple things are hard." I was happy to help. Mystery solved. Iran's escalation was no ad hoc step by Quds Force field commanders, but a systematic ratcheting up of what Iran called maximum resistance to U.S. pressure. This shift in Iran's strategy and its continued enhancement of terrorist groups and other surrogate forces underlined the risks of any perceived weakening of U.S. resolve, which would lead Tehran to conclude it had the upper hand. Over the next 4 months, Trump's erratic behavior made this risk palpable. In the meantime, on May 8th, Rouhani announced that 60 days later, Iran was prepared to violate 4 key elements of the nuclear deal. Those, 1, limiting its stockpile of low-enriched reactor-grade uranium to 300 kilograms, 2, limiting its heavy water stockpile to 130 metric tons, with Iran prepared to sell any excess for export, 3, limiting its level of uranium enrichment to 3.67% of the U-235 isotope, that is, moving toward higher enrichment levels approaching weapons grade, and 4, prohibiting the Arak heavy water reactor from becoming a breeder reactor for plutonium, an alternative to enriched uranium for nuclear weapons fissile material. Rouhani, in a parallel letter to Putin, threatened to withdraw from the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, an interesting twist for a country purportedly not seeking nuclear weapons. The 4 limits Iran was rejecting were central to the nuclear deal. If its nuclear program was truly only civil in nature, Tehran had no need to breach any of the restrictions. The only rational explanation for Rouhani's threat was to reduce the breakout time for Iran to acquire enough highly enriched uranium to begin fabricating weapons. Rouhani's extortionate demands and the consequent trajectory toward nuclear weapons got the Europeans' attention. This could have been a moment of truth for Britain, France, and Germany, but it wasn't. They rejected Rouhani's ultimatum for its tone, but ignored the substance of his statements. At the Pentagon, Dunford said he wanted clear objectives and clear orders if he had to take the possibility of action against Iran seriously. In part, this reflected Mattis's argument. The national security strategy listed China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran as our major threats, meaning, in Mattis's words, that Iran was a fourth-tier threat, implicitly unworthy of much attention. Although it had been written before I arrived, I always assumed this meant that these 4 countries taken together represented the first tier of threats. In that first tier, Iran may have been 4th, but only because we did not yet believe it had nuclear weapons. I argued that if the policy was to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons, we had to be prepared to use military force. For 25 years, people had been unwilling to do what was necessary to stop North Korea from becoming a nuclear weapons state, and that unwillingness had brought us to the point where North Korea had nuclear weapons. I recounted how Bush 43 had said it was unacceptable for Iran to have nuclear weapons, and that I used to say, "I think when the president says it is unacceptable, he means it is unacceptable." I was wrong. That's not what Bush or his predecessors or his successors really meant. We did accept North Korea's getting nuclear weapons. To avoid that outcome with Iran, we had to keep upping the pressure, economically, politically, and militarily. Dunford asked if I really thought the administration's announced policy of maximum pressure would change Iran's behavior. I said it was almost impossible to conceive of the present regime's doing so, and that only full-out regime change would ultimately prevent Iran from possessing nuclear weapons. We were likely near our last chance. Dunford said he assessed it the same way. He believed Iran did not think we were serious about using force, either on the nuclear issue or even on defending ourselves against the attacks we now worried about from the Quds Force in the Persian or Arabian, depending on where you lived, Gulf, the Red Sea, Iraq, and Afghanistan. That is what Dunford meant when he worried Iran would miscalculate. Tehran thought it could develop nuclear weapons or even attack us in the region without fear of retaliation. Perhaps Dunford and Shanahan were surprised to hear all this, so I said, "It's not like I've been hiding my views on this over the years. which they laughingly acknowledged. This was a very useful discussion. Unlike Mattis, I thought, Dunford wasn't fighting the conclusion. He just wanted to be sure we understood the implications. It was certainly clear to him when we finished that I did. This was at least a part of the larger discussion Dunford wanted on Iran. During these days, I went to the Hill frequently to brief key House and Senate members, including Mitch McConnell later on May 9th, so they knew exactly what we faced. As we were wrapping up, McConnell said, "I don't envy your job." And I said, "I could say the same about yours." McConnell laughed and replied, "Your job is much harder than mine." The history of our inadequate responses to direct Iran strikes against U.S. civilian and military targets in the Middle East was fully in the public record, starting with the seizure of our embassy in Tehran in 1979 and the Iranian-instigated 1983 attack on the Marine barracks in Beirut, resulting in American, French, and Italian forces being withdrawn from Lebanon, and continuing to the absence of U.S. retaliation for Iran's attacks via Shia militia groups on Embassy Baghdad and our Basra consulate in September 2018. This long string of passivity, extending to the current day, had convinced Iran it could act with virtual impunity in the region. As this latest debate about Iran was on inside the administration, my view was that the Pentagon clearly had a lot of work to do to make up for Mattis's lack of interest in confronting its nuclear weapons program. It was during this period of internal discussions over Iran that Trump was asked by a reporter, "Are you satisfied with the advice you received from John Bolton?" Trump answered, "Yeah, John is very good. He has strong views on things, but that's okay. I actually tempered John, which is pretty amazing, isn't it? Nobody thought that was going to happen. I'm the one that tempers him. But that's okay. I have different sides. I mean, I have John Bolton, and I have other people that are a little more dovish than him. And ultimately, I make the decision. No, I like John. I get very good advice from John." Can you imagine which words the media quoted? White House Communications Director Mercy Schlapp described Trump's tone as affectionate, which I told her struck me as optimistic. On May 9th, we converted Trump's regular intelligence briefing into a larger discussion of Iran, with Shanahan, Dunford, and Pompeo also attending, along with the regular crew. As we were sitting down in front of the Resolute desk, Trump said, "Congratulations," to Shanahan, producing a look of confusion until Trump said, "I'm nominating you as Secretary of Defense," which brought general approval and handshakes, although the decision was long overdue. Pompeo briefed Trump on his recent visit to Iraq, which inevitably kick-started Trump into enumerating the Bush 43 administration's errors. "Worst president we ever had," said Trump. As was often the case when discussing Iran, Trump raised John Kerry. Trump was obsessed with the idea of prosecuting Kerry for violating the Logan Act, a rarely invoked 1799 law prohibiting private citizens from negotiating with foreign governments. Without doubt, Kerry was trying to persuade Iran to stay in the Iran nuclear deal and wait Trump out until 2020, when a Democrat would assuredly win election and revive it. That said, prosecuting him was a non-starter. The Logan Act violates the First Amendment and, as a criminal statute, is unconstitutionally void for vagueness, but it is still often used to intimidate the unwary. In Trump's mind, Mike Flynn, his first national security advisor, had been unfairly threatened with prosecution under it, which was a fair point, and he wanted to wield it against Kerry. In meeting after meeting in the Oval, Trump would ask Attorney General William Barr or anybody else listening to launch a prosecution. I am confident no one ever did any such thing. I tried early on explaining to Trump the likelihood the Logan Act would be declared unconstitutional if tested in court, but I failed utterly. As long as Trump is president, and probably thereafter, he will search for a lawyer willing to prosecute Kerry. If I were Carrie, I wouldn't lose any sleep over it. Back to reality, Dunford stressed that Iran didn't believe we would respond to the attacks they were contemplating. Trump answered immediately, "They don't understand us very well." We talked about the various military and other options, and sure enough, Trump came back to Kerry. "I'm surprised they're not calling. It's because of Kerry saying, 'You're going to make me look bad. We're going to win.'" Dunford and others, myself included, were surprised how positive Trump was about striking some of the targets I suggested, with Dunford saying correctly, "You've got to be prepared for the next step." "I'm prepared," Trump answered. "Chairman Kim will be watching. You, Shanahan and Dunford, may want to think about building up." "That's why we're here, Mr. President," Dunford responded, giving specifics on what would be needed. Trump did not approve carte blanche, but he did say he wanted the Arab allies to pay for it, a familiar theme. After we discussed North Korea, Venezuela, Israel, Syria, and a few other topics, the meeting broke. I returned to my office, where several of the others had gathered to carry on the conversation. I asked Shanahan and Dunford if they had what they needed from Trump, and it was clear they knew exactly what Trump wanted, which I saw as effectively a reversal of the Mattis approach. The sit room called me early on Sunday, May 12th, to report an oil tanker near the Strait of Hormuz had been hit by some kind of munition and was on fire. Perhaps up to 4 ships had been struck. I told the sit room to awaken Kupperman and others if they hadn't already. I took a shower, got dressed, and had my Secret Service detail head for the White House. I called Dunford from the car shortly after 5 o'clock a.m., finding he had essentially the same information as I. I arrived at the West Wing at about 5:20, immediately calling Dan Coats to make sure he was aware. As I was hanging up with Coats, Dunford called to confirm one tanker was on fire and that none appeared to be American-owned or registered. I wondered aloud if Iran was deliberately testing the United States by attacking non-American assets. Dunford said he believed goading us was definitely part of Iran's strategy. It was early, with incomplete information, but a major event was undoubtedly unfolding. After a few more calls, I went down to the sit room where the round-the-clock staff was gathering all the available data and where Kupperman had been since his arrival. We now knew the ships under attack had been lying at anchor in the Gulf of Oman, off the United Arab Emirates port of Fujairah. Information was still spotty and sometimes contradictory, such as reports of explosions in Fujairah itself, which the city government promptly denied and which turned out to be untrue. One ship was likely Norwegian, 2 Saudi, and 1 Emirati, and the attacks were by either frogmen who had attached limpet mines to the tanker's hulls, or perhaps short-range rockets fired from small naval craft. By the end of Sunday, the frogman option seemed the most viable, and that was confirmed in subsequent days by U.S. Special Operations personnel. By about 6:15 a.m., I concluded it was time to call Trump. Although this was the second time in 2 weeks I would almost certainly be waking him up, the first time being the April 30th uprising in Venezuela, I decided to go ahead. I briefed him on what we knew, and he asked, "What should we do?" I said we would continue gathering information, be alert for other possible attacks, and start thinking about what a military response could look like. "But why wouldn't we know about this?" he asked, still apparently believing we knew everything. I explained, as I had many times before, that we were not omniscient, and that I would keep him posted. Later in the day, speaking with Pompeo, Trump would wonder again why we hadn't known of the attack in advance. I left messages for Mulvaney, who was at Camp David with House and Senate members on some kind of retreat. I also had the sit room contact Embassy Oslo, Embassy Abu Dhabi, and Embassy Riyadh to pulse their host governments and find out what they knew. My tentative thought was that these 3 governments should call for an emergency Security Council meeting to put the spotlight on Iran. I spoke with Pompeo at about 6:25, and he agreed with this approach. At 7:30, I called Pence and briefed him, having already asked Kupperman to convene a deputies' meeting at 8 o'clock a.m. to decide how to work on a response, the first of three that day. Several agencies grumbled at being bothered on a Sunday. By 8 o'clock, information was still fragmentary. The Saudis, for reasons best known to them, at first denied that any attacks had occurred, but later reversed themselves. We were closely consulting with all of our affected allies, watching especially carefully the Iranian disinformation campaigns which were already underway. At 8:20, Norway confirmed publicly that its ship had been hit, saying there were no casualties and the ship remained seaworthy. Starting at 8:40, I spoke to Dunford three times in rapid succession. By then, we had pictures of a hole in the side of one of the ships taken by the ship's crew, which he said was clearly not caused by a drone. Dunford called again at 8:50 to say allies were confirming much of what we had heard, but Iran's disinformation efforts were picking up, claiming there were 7 to 10 ships on fire and that U.S. and French planes had been spotted nearby. Tehran was vying for the Chutzpah of the Year award, but they knew many around the world were pre-wired to believe them. Dunford and I talked about what to do if the whole thing was primarily just an Iranian influence operation. It was one reason why, through the day, the U.S. government said nothing officially. We were very sensitive not to do Iran's work for it, saying something that might inadvertently cause or accelerate oil price increases. At 8:57, Dunford called again to say Pentagon officials were recalling an incident a decade ago when Iran tried to lure us into conflict by putting fake mines in front of the Grace Hopper, a guided missile destroyer. Hopper was a pioneering female computer scientist in the Navy, whose work was central to cryptanalysis for breaking enemy codes in World War II, rising to the rank of Rear Admiral. I told Dunford how Yale rewrote history in 2017, renaming my college, Calhoun, for Hopper, one of Yale's first female PhDs in mathematics. I asked for a picture of her eponymous destroyer for the college common room to see how that suited the leftist faculty and students. At least we had something to laugh about on a potentially grim day. We worried about further attacks, especially against our embassies and consulates. I called Trump again shortly after noon just to check in. By then, Trump was moving toward believing there had been no attack at all, so I tried to explain more fully all that we were hearing, although our fact-gathering and research was still ongoing. As time dragged on, new information was scarce. At about 4:45 p.m., Dunford passed on the Pentagon's assessment that damage to the four tankers appeared light and that, at the United Arab Emirates' invitation, we were sending teams to Fujairah the next day to go in the water and assess the damage. I called Trump one last time at 5:15 to update him on what we knew and were watching, as well as our view that we should not say anything publicly until we knew more. "Yes," he said immediately. "Low-key it. Don't say anything." He wanted the Gulf Arabs to pay the costs of whatever operations we were undertaking, riffing again that we should have taken Iraq's oil after invading in 2003. At the end of the call, he said, "Thanks, John. Bye," which indicated he was satisfied with where we were. I left for home around 5:30. At Trump's regular intel briefing near noon, he asked immediately, "Why aren't they, the Iranians, talking?" He just couldn't believe they didn't want to talk and still harbored the idea that Pompeo and I were blocking their efforts to speak with him. Based on what we knew, however, there was simply no indication Tehran was interested in speaking with us. Trump was even more forceful than before that he wanted the Arab oil-producing countries to bear the full cost of whatever we were doing. After discussing the risks to our personnel in Iraq, Trump filibustered on Syria and why we should get out entirely, not to mention Afghanistan and then Iraq, while we were at it. "Call Pompeo and tell him to remember Benghazi," Trump concluded. On the other hand, Trump was clear, as I explained to Shanahan later, that he wanted a very robust response if Americans were killed, something significantly greater than a tit-for-tat retaliation. One related and potentially important augmentation of Iran's capabilities involved its ballistic missile program. Testing continued apace in 2018 and 2019, although there were a fair number of test failures at launch or shortly thereafter. Although we took comfort from the failures, I remembered, growing up in the 1950s and 60s, American scientists describing Vanguard and Jupiter C rockets blowing up on the launch pad as 90% successes. They learned from failures as well as from impressive launches. Almost inevitably, as Iran's launch testing continued and made progress, its threat in the region and ultimately globally would grow. But it was simply not something, despite repeated efforts, I could get Trump to focus on strategically. After a failed Iranian test launch of a Safir missile, however, he did tweet on August 30th, "The United States of America was not involved in the catastrophic accident during final launch preparations for the Safir SLV launch at Semnan Launch Site 1 in Iran. I wish Iran best wishes and good luck in determining what happened at Site 1. That set tongues wagging for some time, since he was implying exactly the opposite of what the tweet said. As Trump said later, "I like to fuck with them." More grand strategy. Early on Tuesday, May 14th, we learned Iran had struck again overnight, hitting two pumping stations on Saudi Arabia's east-west pipeline. Although Yemen's Houthis claimed credit, there were those who believed the attack came from Shia militia groups in Iraq, in either case, launched under Iran's direction and control. This time, the Saudis quickly announced the attacks publicly, so I called Trump at about 8:30. He reacted calmly, but said of Iran, "If they hit us, we will hit them hard, I can tell you that." As he left the White House for Louisiana to dedicate a new liquefied natural gas export facility, somehow accompanied by Gordon Sondland and some random EU commissioner Sondland had persuaded Mulvaney to allow onto Air Force One, reporters asked about news reports he was planning to send 120,000 new troops to the Middle East. Trump replied that it was fake news, adding, "And if we did that, we'd send a hell of a lot more troops than that." By this time, even Democrats were starting to worry that the magnitude and tempo of Iran's threat was growing unacceptably. Public awareness later that day of the ordered departure of over 100 non-essential personnel from Embassy Baghdad added to the concern. The next day, Trump chaired an NSC meeting at 9:30 a.m. to get a better sense of his thinking. Dunford and Shanahan appropriately urged Trump several times to look beyond simply the next immediate decision and consider moves farther down the road. Shanahan said they wanted to assess his tolerance for risk, to which Trump responded, "I have an unbelievable capacity for risk. Risk is good," followed by a lecture on his views on Iraq, why he wanted to get out of Syria, why, as he had said elsewhere, such as in the case of Iraq, we should take the oil in Venezuela after ousting Maduro, and why he thought China was the greatest cheater in the world, as recently proven by their behavior in the trade negotiations, thus precipitating a riff on economic power as the basis of military power. That brought up the subject of aircraft carriers and another discourse on how the steam systems for lifting planes to and from carrier flight decks were vastly superior to the electronic systems used on the incredibly expensive Gerald Ford, $16 billion to date, said Trump. Finicky listeners can look up the actual cost on their own. I don't want facts slowing down the narrative flow. Despite the seamen themselves saying they could fix the steam systems by hitting them with a hammer, but couldn't begin to understand how to fix the electronic systems. That same logic applied to the steam catapults used to help launch planes, which Trump wanted to reinstall on all carriers that had moved to more advanced systems. Suddenly, the CIA's Haspel, to her credit, broke in and began her portion of the briefing, stopping the Trump train in its tracks. Of course, I can't describe what she had to say, but the rest of us counted our blessings when she started to say it. John Sullivan, in Pompeo's absence, described the drawdown in embassy Baghdad personnel, which lit Trump off on Afghanistan. "Get the fuck out," said Trump, which I took to mean both Iraq and Afghanistan, although before we could find out, Trump was asking, "How long until we get out of Syria except for those 400, 200 in At-Tanf, and a couple hundred with the projected multilateral observer force?" "Just a few months," Dunford replied. "Iraq doesn't give a shit about us," Trump continued, referring to the Erbil consulate, saying, "Lock the door and leave." Then opining, "That aircraft carrier, the Lincoln, was a beautiful sight." Perhaps thinking about the Navy reminded Trump of the Army and General Mark Milley, who would succeed Dunford on October 1st. Trump asked if we should start inviting Milley to NSC meetings, saying he would leave the decision to Dunford. The notion was thoroughly wrong. Only one of us sat in these chairs at any given point, and there was a time to start and a time to finish. No one, including Milley, with whom I discussed this subject subsequently, thought it was a good idea to have both of them attend until the transition was imminent, if then. Dunford replied evenly, "I'll leave any time you want, Mr. President," which fortunately backed Trump off. I told Dunford privately after the meeting there was no way he was leaving before his term ended, or that Milley would attend NSC meetings until the right time. Dunford remained impassive, but it wouldn't surprise me if he had been an inch away from getting up and walking out of the sit room for good. After the Lincoln reverie, Trump moved to a short-form version of the soliloquy on John Kerry and the Logan Act. "The Iranians aren't talking only because of John Kerry," he mused, but Shanahan, seeing how successful Haspel had been by just ignoring Trump and interrupting, resumed talking about more boring things like risk, cost, and timing regarding the various options we might consider, including the use of force. "I don't think they should start on building nuclear weapons," Trump offered. When Dunford tried to get more specific on what we might do and when in response to an Iranian attack, Trump said the Gulf Arabs could pay. Dunford kept trying to get Trump to focus on specific options along a graduated ladder of possible responses, but somehow we veered off to South Africa and what Trump was hearing about the treatment of white farmers, asserting he wanted to grant them asylum and citizenship. The discussion on targets then resumed, much of it to my satisfaction. Unfortunately, the mention of our remaining troop presence in Iraq led Trump to inquire, "Why don't we take them out? In Syria, we got rid of ISIS." What I heard next was shocking, but I distinctly remember hearing him say, "I don't care if ISIS comes back into Iraq." On Iran, discussion of possible U.S. actions continued, but then zoomed to Afghanistan as Trump complained about how much we were paying soldiers in the Afghan government army, undissuaded when Shanahan said the average was only about $10 a day. 1 week after the attack on the four tankers on May 19th, the sit room called me in the early afternoon to relay a report of an explosion, perhaps a Katyusha rocket landing in Zora Park, a kilometer from our embassy in Baghdad. I called Dunford and then Pompeo, neither having heard anything, but we all agreed that a Katyusha launch in Baghdad was hardly news. At about 5 p.m., Trump tweeted, "If Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Never threaten the United States again." The next day, Trump complained at the intelligence briefing about news stories that we were asking to speak to Iran's leaders. He tweeted later, "The fake news put out a typically false statement without any knowledge that the United States was trying to set up a negotiation with Iran. This is a false report. Iran will call us if and when they are ever ready. In the meantime, their economy continues to collapse. Very sad for the Iranian people." Rouhani himself said publicly, "Today's situation is not suitable for talks." I thought Iran was doing a better job trolling Trump than he was doing in return. They said publicly they knew Trump wanted to talk, but was being frustrated by advisors like me, or that Trump wanted peace, but his advisors wanted war. Much like Kim Jong-un's efforts to separate Trump from others and deal with him alone, this was all a head game. It did bother me that the U.S. media credulously reported these foreign assertions as if they were perfectly logical, thus amplifying Pyongyang and Tehran propaganda efforts. Much worse was that Trump also appeared to take the stories seriously. Prior presidents would have rejected characterizations by foreign adversaries of their own advisors, but Trump seemed to have the opposite reaction. It was difficult to explain this to outsiders, but perfectly normal in the Trump White House. The next day, for example, he said to me in an accusatory tone, "I don't want people to be asking Iran to talk." I replied, "Well, I sure as hell am not." Trump acknowledged, "No, you wouldn't be." While I flew to Japan to help prepare for Trump's state visit with the emperor, Shanahan and Dunford met with him to discuss increasing the defensive preparations for our forces already in the Gulf, which Pompeo and Kupperman also attended. Before the discussion got too far, however, Trump asked, "When are we going to get out of fucking Afghanistan? Can you use some of them here?" meaning the Middle East. Dunford explained that the forces in Afghanistan had different skills. "That fucking Mattis," said Trump, and off he went about how he had given Mattis the rules of engagement he wanted in Afghanistan, and we still hadn't won. "When are we going to get out of Syria?" Trump rolled on. "All we did was save Assad." Dunford tried to explain that in Syria, we were continuing to do what Trump had agreed to months before, which prompted Trump to ask which of two of our Arab friends produced better soldiers. Somewhat startled, Dunford recovered to say which ones he thought were better soldiers, but Trump then asked, "Aren't they all the same size?" Composure now restored, Dunford said there were differences in culture. Somehow, the discussion reverted to the subject at hand, and Trump accepted the Pentagon's deployment recommendations and agreed they should be announced promptly. Although Trump hadn't told me at the time, he had asked Abe to get involved between Iran and the U.S., and Abe had taken the request seriously. Given the growing threats to U.S. and allied interests in the Persian Gulf, this was a particularly inopportune time for this latest misdirection, especially since it was clear to me that Trump was pushing Abe into a public role that could only end in failure, which it ultimately did. Abe was thinking of visiting Iran in mid-June before the Osaka G20 meeting, which made it even more high-profile. When I met with Abe himself while in Japan just before Trump's state visit to meet the emperor, Abe stressed that he would undertake the trip to Iran only if Trump wanted him to and there was some prospect of being helpful. I obviously couldn't say that I thought the entire initiative was a terrible idea, but I suggested Abe speak to Trump about it privately and form his own judgment on how to proceed. During Trump's state visit, Abe and Trump got down to business on Monday, May 27th at 11 a.m. in the Akasaka Palace's Asahi no Ma room with just the two leaders, Yachi and myself, and the interpreters. Abe summarized the previous evening's dinner with Trump, reaffirming his visit to Iran on June 12th and 13th. By this point, Trump was seriously falling asleep. He never fell out of his chair and didn't seem to miss anything important, but he was, in the immortal words of one of my Fort Polk drill sergeants, checking his eyelids for pinholes. Zarif had been in Tokyo the week before, and Abe said he had deduced that Iran was suffering and had a sense of crisis. He said he thought Trump's decision to send the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln was very effective. He was ready to decide about going to Iran, but had recently spoken to some of our Arab friends who were very critical of the idea. Trump interjected that Abe shouldn't be bothered, because the United States was defending them. We were calling our own shots, and that nobody told us what to do. After further exchanges, Trump said inflation was 1,000,000% in Iran, the GDP was minus 10%, and the country was hurting badly. Then, somehow, he said that Moon was begging him to come to South Korea on this trip, but he had declined. Trump thought Iran was dying and had to make a deal. He wanted to meet with them immediately, halfway in between, geographically, I think he meant. Although he didn't want to humiliate Iran and, indeed, hoped they would be successful, it was clear they couldn't have nuclear weapons, which were already too prevalent worldwide, a point he repeated twice, urging Abe to call the Iranians and tell them that after he left Japan. Trump especially wanted the Iranians to know they shouldn't listen to John Kerry. He believed he could do the negotiations in one day, not stretched out over 9 to 12 months. Of course, Trump was also totally prepared to go to war if he had to, and Iran should understand that. If they didn't, they would never make a deal. Trump had around him large numbers of people who wanted to go to war now, but it would never happen because of him. Vintage Trump, moving from a deal in one day to all-out war in mere seconds. Abe said he would convey Trump's message, concluding by suggesting that, as he prepared for his Iran visit, Yachi and I should finalize our proposal to deliver in Iran. That was the best news all morning. Trump said Abe should proceed as fast as he could. At this point, shortly before noon, the participants in the larger meeting came in, and Abe started off the second meeting by saying he and Trump had had a very productive meeting with their national security advisors, which was one way to look at it. While traveling onward from Tokyo to London for the UK state visit, I overnighted for refueling and crew rest in Abu Dhabi, where I had a chance on May 29th to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed of the United Arab Emirates, whom I had known for many years, along with my Emirati counterpart Sheikh Tanun bin Zayed and others. The Crown Prince repeated several times that he couldn't tell me how important it was that I had come there, and the signal it sent all around the Gulf. He and the Emiratis were very worried about our non-response to Iran's recent provocations and the accelerating buildup of missiles and drones in the hands of the Houthis and the Shia militia in Iraq, and Iran's aid to the Taliban and ISIS in Afghanistan. They also couldn't understand, having heard from Abe, why Trump wanted to talk to Iran. I tried, unsuccessfully, to explain Trump's idea that talking didn't really mean or imply anything other than talking. The Crown Prince and the Gulf Arabs didn't agree with that, and more important, Iran didn't either. They all saw it as weakness. In fact, after I arrived in London, Saudi National Security Advisor Musaid bin Mohammed Al Ayban, whom I had not previously met, reached me to say that his Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, wanted me to know how unhappy they were that Abe was going to Iran. I urged that the Crown Prince call Trump directly, thinking he might have better luck than I. I left for London as discouraged as during the Obama years, when one Middle East leader after another would ask why Obama thought the Ayatollahs would ever voluntarily give up terrorism or nuclear weapons. After the UK state visit, the Brits and then the French hosted D-Day 75th anniversary celebrations, first on June 5th in Portsmouth, from which many of the landing forces had embarked, and then at Normandy itself on June 6th. After the Normandy festivities, Macron hosted a lunch for Trump, with Iran the main subject. Macron was fixed on the July 8th deadline of Iran's ultimatum to Europe to provide the economic benefits Tehran thought it was owed under the nuclear deal, or Iran would begin breaching key limitations in it. In European Union theology, such breaches might well signal the death of the deal. Plus, in my view, Macron wanted in on Abe's action. What would we be willing to give up? Macron wanted to know. Would we be ready to alleviate the sanctions? And what would we want from Iran? Reducing its military activities in Syria and Yemen? After explaining again the effects on Iran of America's reimposition of sanctions, Trump went after Kerry for violating the Logan Act and convincing Iran not to negotiate. Mnuchin said we could easily turn sanctions off and on regarding Iran, which was flatly incorrect as a matter of sanctions effectiveness and completely unauthorized by anything Trump had said to that point. He may have been moving in that direction, but Mnuchin was pandering, surrendering without even contemplating the signal that would burst worldwide if sanctions were relaxed, or even asking what we would get in return. Macron said expressly that he was worried Iran would flatly reject negotiations, which I thought a near certainty, thereby saving us from ourselves. This entire conversation was a disaster. Abe's visit to Iran was bad enough, but adding the Europeans could only make it worse. They had a completely different agenda, namely saving the nuclear deal at any cost, rather than acting seriously against the underlying problem. Of course, if Iran continued its belligerent actions and struck new U.S. or allied targets, any U.S. military response would stop any Japanese or European diplomacy dead in its tracks. That is what kept my thoughts of resignation in check, for now. As I was flying back to Andrews, Kupperman called shortly after 6 p.m. Washington time. Just hours before, a U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drone, a version of the Predator, had been shot down near Hodeidah in Yemen by a surface-to-air missile likely fired by the Houthis, or Iranians, from Houthi territory. The Houthis claimed credit, so Kupperman scheduled a deputies committee for 8 a.m. Friday morning to consider how to respond. As it turned out, we did nothing, in large part because the military, in the person of Joint Chiefs of Staff Vice Chairman Paul Selva, insisted we were uncertain who had actually shot the Reaper down and who had committed the other recent attacks. My assessment could not have been more to the contrary. Selva acted like a prosecutor, demanding that we show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, which we were actually close to here, the emphasis being on reasonable. Who else would do this besides Iran or its surrogates? But more important, we were not trying criminal cases in court. We were in a messy real world where knowledge was always imperfect. Of course, that real world also includes bureaucrats expert at ensuring they don't do what they don't want to do, which was an especially powerful problem with a president whose views sometimes zigzagged hourly. As if this weren't bad enough, Defense Department civilians were also trying to pressure Israel not to take self-defense measures, which Pompeo told me that he had personally intervened, and rightly so, to overturn. The Mattis spirit lived on. Yachi called me at 8:30 a.m. on Friday, June 7th, to go over Abe's talking points for the Iran visit, which described a proposal that could have come from Macron or Merkel, it was so generous to Iran. Japan was schizophrenic on Iran and North Korea, soft on the former because of oil, and hard on the latter because of grim reality, and I strove repeatedly with mixed success to make the Japanese see how similar the two threats were. Japan quite rightly understood that maximum pressure was the right strategy to apply against North Korea, and if an EU country had proposed for Pyongyang what Abe was proposing for Tehran, he would have emphatically and unhesitatingly rejected it. I wanted to keep as much distance as possible between Japan and the Europeans, because I thought their objectives were so different, inconsistent, in fact. Weakening the sanctions against Kim Jong-un would only have encouraged him to hold out for better terms on the nuclear side, just as easing the strain on Iran would have done the same in Tehran, all of which I explained to Yachi at length. I briefed Yachi on the Iranian threats we faced, just so he knew how serious they were, using the shooting down of the Reaper drone and the other attacks described earlier to illustrate the point. I also told Yachi how important Trump thought Abe's trip was, how difficult it was, and how important to get it right. I was hardly going to undercut Abe's mission, but I was just as determined not to give carte blanche, especially with France and Mnuchin stumbling around trying to save the JCPOA. On Monday, June 10th, I spoke to Trump about how Abe's plans were developing. In our discussion, Trump made clear that Abe's idea was acceptable only if they, Iran, make the deal, meaning not a concession now, but only after Iran had satisfactorily given up nuclear weapons. This was a crucial distinction, but one Trump himself had trouble keeping straight with respect to both Iran and North Korea. I called Pompeo to tell him the good news, and he said, "I guess that's it then," meaning we were out of danger, at least for now. Nonetheless, he was less optimistic than I about being saved from what could become the Trump administration's version of the cash on pallets delivered to Iran under Obama. Based on his conversations with Japan's foreign minister, he worried they were not prepared to accept what Trump had conveyed to me earlier. To both of us, as Iran and North Korea developments converged in June and July, the risks were growing serious. On Iran, Pompeo told me a dozen foreign ministers called him once word of Abe's mission began to get around, believing the maximum pressure campaign was off and offering to help mediate. It was more proof that only Trump among world leaders believed talking to adversaries was purely content neutral. As Pompeo put it, if you only want a nuclear deal with Iran, don't care how good it is, and also don't care about ballistic missiles, support for terrorism, or much else, that deal already existed, the Iran nuclear deal. North Korea was just as bad. We were, in Pompeo's words, in the danger zone of Trump's completely undercutting his own policies. What the rest of the world made of our disarray and confusion was less certain, because for the moment, courtesy of the New York Times and others, the media were focusing on the split between Trump and me on North Korea and Iran. The bigger picture was the split between Trump and Trump. That evening, Abe called Trump to review his final Iran script, which was about as innocuous as we could make it. Nonetheless, Abe asked about his proposed program, saying he understood that the United States was skeptical about presenting this idea to Iran at this point in time. Trump simply didn't respond to Abe's comment, which signaled to everyone on the call he would be happy if Abe didn't raise it with Iran. I could hardly believe our good fortune. This was not just dodging a bullet, but dodging a MIRVed ICBM.